In 1966, residents of South Chicago were traumatized by a deviant who was found to have systematically tortured, raped, and murdered his victims. What was the story of this bizarre and horrendous murderer? What drove him to such madness? And how was he caught and punished for his crimes? Today, we explore the story of Richard Speck on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Richard Benjamin Speck was an American mass murderer who systematically tortured, raped, and murdered 8 student nurses from South Chicago Community Hospital on the night of July 13th into the early morning hours of July 14th, 1966. He was convicted at trial and sentenced to death, but the sentence was later overturned due to issues with jury selection at the trial. Speck died of a heart attack after 25 years in prison. In 1996, videotapes featuring Speck were shown before the Illinois State Legislature to highlight some of the illegal activities that took place in prisons. Richard Benjamin Speck was born in Kirkwood, Illinois, the 7th of 8 children of Benjamin Franklin Speck and Mary Margaret Speck. Family moved to Monmouth, Illinois, shortly after Speck's birth. Speck and his younger sister, Carolyn, were much younger than their 4 older sisters and 2 older brothers. Speck's eldest brother, Robert, died at the age of 23 in an automobile accident in 1952. Speck's father worked as a packer at Western Stoneware in Monmouth and had previously worked as a farmer and logger. Speck was very close to his father, who died in 1947 from a heart attack at the age of 53. Speck was 6 years old at the time. After a few years, Speck's religious teetotaler mother fell in love with a traveling insurance salesman from Texas, Carl August Rudolph Lindbergh, whom she met on a train trip to Chicago. The hard-drinking Lindbergh, with a 25-year criminal record that started with forgery and included several arrests for drunk driving, was the opposite of Speck's sober, hard-working father. Speck's mother married Lindbergh on May 10, 1950, in Palo Pinto, Texas. Speck and his younger sister Carolyn stayed with their married sister Sarah Thornton in Monmouth for a few months so Speck could finish second grade before joining their mother and Lindbergh in rural Santo, Texas, 40 miles west of Fort Worth, where Speck attended third grade. After a year in Santo, Speck moved with his mother, stepfather, and sister Carolyn to East Dallas, a section of Dallas, Texas, living at 10 addresses in poor neighborhoods over the next dozen years. Speck loathed his often drunk and frequently absent stepfather, who psychologically abused him with insults and threats. Speck, a poor student who needed glasses for reading but refused to wear them, struggled through Dallas public schools from 4th through 8th grade, repeating the 8th grade at J.L. Long Junior High School, in part because he refused to speak in class because of a lifelong fear of people staring at him. In autumn of 1957, Speck started 9th grade at Crozer Technical High School, but failed every subject and did not return for the second semester in January of 1958, dropping out just after his 16th birthday. Speck started drinking alcohol at age 12, and by 15, he was getting drunk almost every day. His first arrest in 1955 at age 13 for trespassing was followed by dozens of other arrests for misdemeanors over the next 8 years. Speck worked as a laborer for the 7-Up Bottling Company in Dallas for almost 3 years, from 1960 to 1963. In October of 1961, Speck met 15-year-old Shirley Annette Malone at the Texas State Fair. She became pregnant after 3 weeks of dating him. Shirley married Speck on January 19, 1962, and initially moved in with him. His mother, Sister Carolyn, and Carolyn's husband. Speck's mother and stepfather had separated, and his stepfather had moved to California. Speck stopped using the name Richard Benjamin Lindbergh. When he got married, he began using the name Richard Benjamin Speck. When Speck's daughter, Robbie Lynn, was born in July 5th of 1962, his wife did not know that Speck was serving a 22-day jail sentence for disturbing the peace in McKinney, Texas, after a drunken melee. In 1963, Speck was caught after he forged and cashed a co-worker's $44 paycheck. He also robbed a grocery store, making away with cigarettes, beer, and $3 in cash. 21-year-old Speck was convicted of forgery and burglary and sentenced to 3 years in prison. He was paroled after serving 16 months from 1963 to 1965 at the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville, Texas. 1 week after his parole on January 9, 1965, Speck was wielding a 17-inch carving knife when he attacked a woman in the parking lot of her apartment building. He fled when the woman screamed. Police arrived within minutes and apprehended Speck a few blocks away. Speck was convicted of aggravated assault, given a 16-month sentence to run concurrently with a parole violation sentence, and returned to prison in Huntsville. But due to an error, he was released just 6 months later on completion of his parole violation sentence on July 2nd, 1965. After his release from prison, Speck worked for 3 months as a driver for the Patterson Meat Company and had 6 accidents with his truck before he was fired for failing to show up for work. In December of 1965, on the recommendation of his mother, Speck, who was by then separated from his wife, moved in with a 29-year-old divorced woman, an ex-professional wrestler who was a bartender at his favorite bar, Jenny's Lounge. I needed someone to babysit her 3 children. In January 1966, Speck's wife filed for divorce. That same month, Speck stabbed a man in a knife fight at Jenny's Lounge. He was charged with aggravated assault, but a defense attorney hired by his mother was able to get the charge reduced to disturbing the peace. Speck was fined $10 and jailed for 3 days after he failed to pay the fine. This was the last time Speck was in the police custody in Dallas. So a really nice kind of beginning to life as far as upbringing, and then kind of what he started to get into. It seems like he was on the right straight and narrow, really, as one would call it.
You know, and you, when you listen to that, like, he went so far off the tracks.
Yeah.
So far. But, like, you wonder if his dad had stayed alive, if it had all been different.
Yeah.
You know, especially if his mom was religious and didn't drink or anything, and she ends up with this guy who's a drunk, and, you know, and I imagine his home life wasn't good after that.
Mm-hmm.
No excuses, but you just have to wonder.
It's not an.
It had turned out differently, and he seemed to have gotten some breaks. Like, he should have been locked up for a lot longer.
Yeah,
more than once.
Well, there was the errors and all that, but yeah, you have to wonder. I mean, just that influence that father, you know, seemed to have on him, that was positive, and then that was suddenly gone, and then the acting out, and it goes beyond acting out to just out of control. And never being able to be reeled back in.
I can kind of understand that, because, you know, there's the anger and grief and sadness from his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then his mom marries somebody, he's still really young, then you're resentful. On top of that, now you're just going to act out because you're pissed off at the world.
Yeah.
And which he did, which is why he started drinking at 12, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then it kind of becomes who you are. You don't care.
Well, I think you have a recipe.
You didn't have anything to care about.
You have a recipe for just, you know, utter madness. And in someone like a Richard Speck, when you have those sort of circumstances, and then you have some sort of a chemical imbalance going on, which I'm sure is there, where there's this mental illness at play.
And drinking on top of it.
And it's a perfect storm. It's where, like, well, maybe if someone didn't have the imbalance, or maybe if someone just had the imbalance but didn't do these other things, you wouldn't get this outcome, what we're about to get into. But when you have all of these things all put together at once, this is the recipe, this is the thing, this is the Mentos in the Coke bottle. It's not putting a spree in the Coke bottle. It's because of what all of these things mean together is what you get. And it's
like, because when you're telling all of that backstory, knowing what's ahead in his life, it's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, anybody could have seen that writing on the wall.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be a stretch for you or me to do what he did, but not so much for this guy. He didn't care.
You know, that's a scary thing about mental health and things like that in our world today, is the fact that we can, if we were today to look at someone like a Richard Speck, and we were to go down their entire list of stuff that they've dealt with, that they've gone through, that they're suffering from, that is their truth, to give you the fun current term. There is not a whole hell of a lot that a loved one or a caretaker or someone who is trying to look out for this person can do to prevent that person from going down a very, very dark path, even though they know it's like the next thing this person's going to do is going to be something like this. Because the laws are all on the side of the person with the problem. It's like, well, we can't do anything until they do the horrible shit. And
yeah, it's very true.
It's like, why are we doing this? Why are we living in this world where that is the case? Like, well, they might not do the horrible shit. Yeah, maybe not. But for the sake of them, for the sake of the other people, when you have the stories and the, or, you know, threats or things like that, there, we it's such a crazy world when it comes to that sort of stuff, as far as what can and cannot be done to prevent another Richard Speck.
Right. From because happening. We have no mental health outlets, or
no,
there's no way for people to get that kind of help that they need.
No, there's not.
And especially back then, there was none of that back then.
Yeah. We think it's horrible now.
And he was probably super intimidating, and his wife, I imagine, had a really hard time dealing with him. And he, you know, and someone like that, he had a rough life, and he was angry at the world, and took it out on everybody.
It's when you
I have no idea that's what that was like.
When you put it all into perspective, you go, and again, it's not to make an excuse and go, well, it makes sense he did that shit. But in a way, you look at it and go, not that it makes sense that he did that shit, but it makes sense. You go, I'm not surprised a person that's
like,
been through that.
You see it coming.
Because
there had to have been people back then that were like, this guy's trouble.
His healthy
and
normal is
it's
so
not gonna stop.
What he views as normal and healthy and acceptable is so far out of whack from the rest of ours. And there's nothing anyone can do to change that other than just wait for him to strike, essentially. It's crazy. Let's jump into the next part of his story. On March 5th, 1966, Speck bought a 12-year-old car. The following evening, he robbed a grocery store and stole 70 cartons of cigarettes, sold them out of the trunk of his car in the grocery store's parking lot, and then abandoned the car. The police traced the car to Speck and issued a warrant for his arrest for burglary on March 8th. An arrest, his 42nd in Dallas, would mean another prison term. So on March 9, 1966, Speck's sister Carolyn drove him to the Dallas bus depot, where he took a bus to Chicago, Illinois. Speck stayed with his sister, Martha Thornton, and her family in Chicago for a few days, and then returned to his boyhood hometown of Monmouth, Illinois, where he initially stayed with some old family friends. Speck's brother Howard was a carpenter in Monmouth and found a job for him sanding plasterboard for another Monmouth carpenter. Speck became angry when he learned his ex-wife had remarried 2 days
after she was granted a divorce on March 16, 1966. He moved to the Christie Hotel in downtown Monmouth on March 25th and spent most of his time at the downtown taverns. At the end of March, while Speck and some acquaintances were on a bar-hopping trip to Gulfport, Illinois, they were detained overnight by police. Thereafter, Speck reportedly threatened a man in a tavern restroom with a knife. On April 3rd, Mrs. Virgil Harris, a 65-year-old resident of Monmouth, returned home at 1 a.m. to find a burglar in her house brandishing a knife. It was a 6-foot-tall white man who was very polite and spoke very softly with a southern drawl. The man blindfolded her, tied her up, raped her, ransacked her house, and stole $2.50 that she had earned babysitting that evening. A week later, Mary Kay Pierce, a 32-year-old barmaid who worked at her brother-in-law's tavern, Frank's Place, in downtown Monmouth, was last seen leaving the tavern at 12:45 a.m. on April 9th. She was reported missing on April 13th, and her body was found that day in an empty hog pen behind the tavern. She had died from a blow to her abdomen that ruptured her liver. Speck had frequented Frank's Place, and the empty hog pen was one of several he had helped build in the preceding month. Some Monmouth police briefly questioned him about Pierce's death when he showed up to collect his final carpentry paycheck on April 15th and asked him to stay in town for further questioning. When police showed up at the Christie Hotel on April 19th to continue questioning Speck, they discovered he had left the hotel a few hours earlier, carrying his suitcase and saying he was just going to the laundromat. He had instead left town. A search of his room turned up a radio and costume jewelry. Mrs. Virgil Harris had reported missing from her house, as well as items reported missing in two other local burglaries in the past month. Then, on July 13th at 11 p.m. in 1966, Speck broke into 2319 East 100th Street, a townhouse in Chicago's Jeffrey Manor neighborhood. The townhouse was functioning as a dormitory for student nurses. He entered and, using only a knife, killed Gloria Davey, Patricia Matusik, Nina Jo Shamal, Pamela Wilkenberg, Suzanne Ferris, Mary Ann Jordan, Merletta Galgrugo, and Valentina Passion. Speck later claimed he was both drunk and high on drugs, may have originally planned to commit a routine burglary. Speck held the women in a room for hours, leading them out one by one, stabbing or strangling each to death, then finally raping and strangling his last victim, Gloria Davey. One woman, Corazan Amaro, escaped death because she crawled and hid under a bed while Speck was out of the room. Speck possibly lost count or might have known eight women lived in the townhouse, but was unaware that a ninth woman was spending the night. Amaro stayed hidden until almost 6 a.m. Fingerprints found at the scene were matched to Speck. 2 days after the murder, Speck was identified by a drifter named Claude Lunsford. Speck, Lunsford, and another man had been drinking the evening of July 15th on the fire escape of the Star Hotel at 617 West Madison. On July 16th, Lunsford recognized a sketch of the murderer in the evening paper and phoned the police at 9:30 p.m. after finding Speck in his room at the Star Hotel. The police, however, did not respond to the call, although the records show the call had been made. Speck then attempted suicide, and the Star Hotel desk clerk phoned the emergency around midnight. Speck was taken to Cook County Hospital at 12:30 a.m. on July 17th. At the hospital, Speck was recognized by Dr. Leroy Smith, a 25-year-old surgical resident physician who had read about the Born to Raise Hell tattoo in the newspaper story. The police were called. Speck was arrested. Concerns over the recent Miranda case that had vacated the convictions of a number of criminals meant Speck was not even questioned for 3 weeks after his arrest. So there you go. I kind of got to the meat of the story, if you will, and I'm not trying to be morbid or anything, but that's, you know, that's where the the big part of his crimes come in. I believe Speck is actually a character or that is portrayed in the Mindhunter series.
Oh.
So that may be where you're going, huh, I've heard this name recently. I believe he's one that's questioned because they're...
I think you're right.
When they're trying to learn about serial killers and the psychology.
And on topic, I do hope they have another season of that.
I do too.
That's another story. Yeah. But there's a lot to unwrap in that last segment. Like you said, he had been arrested... Did you say 42 times?
Yes. Yeah.
While in Dallas?
Yeah.
Like, how? How can anybody be arrested 42 times and not be imprisoned?
That's why they finally, you know.
I mean, just the, if nothing else, the, like, okay, you haven't committed a felony yet, but 25 misdemeanors adds up to a prison sentence. You know what I mean?
And let's do it concurrently. Yeah. I mean, eventually this is where you get the system that we have today because these things were going on like this, where it's like, well, slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist. And now it's, you know, you have
42 times.
Yeah.
And then he gets help. It's like, well, we're going to ship you back home. And, you know, like. And probably at that point, was it his sister that helped him get back or something?
Yeah.
Probably at that point, she was like, get him out of here.
I would be fearing for my own life, you know, even though, you know, at that point, it's like, it doesn't matter if you're family or not. You know, your brother's out of his goddamn mind.
Well, imagine what he was like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Yes. It was freaking crazy.
You're just waiting for him to turn on you.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's probably drinking a lot. One of those really horrible drunks, my guess. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
And the fact
I don't think he was a funny drunk. Yeah.
He's not in the corner cracking jokes. Yeah. And after
so only get drunk, he's so funny.
And after 42 times of being arrested, and the family's probably well aware of this factoid, they're like, okay, here's my options. I either ship him away or I call the police and then he's mad at me. And then when he gets released again for the 43rd time, he's going to come kill me. So I'm going to ship him away.
You just didn't open a beer for him properly.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody like that could go off for anything.
Exactly. So there's no protections.
So before he killed all those women,
yeah,
he had only, and I don't mean that only, but he had raped one other person and killed another person by hitting her.
I believe
probably.
And
like,
somehow
that didn't sound like maybe he had intended to kill her.
And somehow he's still out there. And
but to go from that, which is horrible,
yeah,
to like one night kill all those women. And what about that poor woman who was there?
Yeah.
She lived through that. I can't even imagine.
I guess here's what troubles me the most. And I'm in no way trying, you know, I'm not.
There's a number of things.
Well, yeah, there's a lot. But here's the thing when it comes to the family of this individual. How the hell do you still communicate at all with this person? How are you at all in any way, shape, or form doing anything where it's like, I'll help you get that ticket to Chicago, I'll help you do anything? How are you not just completely isolating yourself 100% away from this person, getting the fuck out of Dodge? I don't understand.
When, I guess a ticket to Chicago is to get them away from
Well, sure, but still, just any
that
communication. I don't understand this thing that people have with other people, and especially families. Maybe I'm just a cold-hearted asshole, but there's only so many strikes people can do against an individual before it's like, you're fucking out. I don't care what your relationship is.
Well, he'd been arrested 42 times in Dallas and still had some kind of relationship with his sister.
That's the thing.
And then he moves in with his family in Illinois.
Yes, and that's where it's like, why? Were they unaware? And if they're unaware, that's a whole different story.
And that could be it because, you know, things today are super easy to find out. And
yeah.
I mean, chances are he would have posted half of his exploits on social media.
Yeah.
But back then, it would have been different. He would, you know, he could have gotten there what he didn't tell him, they didn't know.
You're probably right. That may be the answer to that question. I'm baffled by folks who continually to take in the horrible individuals that continue to hurt and destroy lives, maybe not directly of the family, but it's like, oh, well, their blood. It's like, fuck that.
People like that are extremely manipulative.
Yeah, you're next.
Extremely intimidating. And you could have been afraid for your own life or.
Yeah.
I mean, don't piss him off because we don't know what he's going to do. And look what he ended up being capable of.
Is it an out of fear thing that happens? Or I don't know. I mean, there's just sometimes I look at that and I go, you know, I mean, I'm all about trying to work things out and try to everybody understand each other. But at some point, there's a lot less shit than murder that you can say, you know what, I'm fucking done. You know, just for the mental health of everybody.
And don't you think, too, in those times, it was so different than it is today. You know, there was
they weren't under quarantine
society. And, you know, like men wore their hats when they went out.
Yeah.
And there was just a different way. And I think there was a total denial, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That he could be like that.
What we don't know won't hurt us type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you don't want everybody to know for appearance's sake.
Sure.
So everything's swept under the rug, 42 arrests in Dallas alone.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's just, I can't even wrap my brain around all that.
No, it's a lot to unpack. Let's continue on with the fine story of Richard Speck. Felony court judge Herbert J. Passion appointed an impartial panel to report on Speck's competence to stand trial and his sanity at the time of the crime. A panel of three physicians suggested by the defense and three physicians selected by the prosecution, consisting of five psychiatrists and one general surgeon. The panel's confidential report deemed Speck competent to stand trial and concluded he had not been insane at the time of the murders. While awaiting trial, Speck participated in twice weekly sessions with part-time Cook County jail psychiatrist Dr. Marvin Ziprion. These continued after Speck's transfer from Sir Mark Memorial Hospital inside Chicago's House of Corrections on July 29, 1966 until February 13, 1967, the day before Speck was transferred to Peoria to stand trial. Ziprion prepared a discharge summary with depression, anxiety, guilt, and shame among Speck's emotions, but also a deep love for his family. He went on to note an obsessive-compulsive personality and a Madonna prostitute attitude towards women. Ziprion maintained Speck viewed women as saintly until he felt betrayed by them for some reason, after which hostility developed. He also diagnosed organic brain syndrome resulting from cerebral injuries suffered earlier in Speck's life and stated he was competent to stand trial but was insane at the time of the crime due to the effects of alcohol and drug use on his organic brain syndrome. Dr. Ziprion did not testify for the defense or the prosecution as both sides were troubled to learn before the trial Ziprion was writing a book about Speck for financial gain. Ziprion also earned the ire of the Cook County Jail, which fired him as its part-time psychiatrist the week after Speck's trial ended. At some point during his interviews with Speck, Ziprion had obtained a written three-sentence consent from Speck authorizing him to tell what I am really like. Ziprion's biography of Speck was published the summer of 1967. Speck's jury trial began April 3, 1967 in Peoria, Illinois, 3 hours southwest of Chicago, with a gag order on the press. In court, Speck was positively identified by the sole surviving student nurse, Corazon Amoro. When Amoro was asked if she could identify the killer of her fellow students, Amoro rose from her seat in the witness box, walked directly in front of Speck, and pointed her finger right at him, nearly touching him, and said, "This is the man." Lieutenant Emil Giese testified regarding the fingerprints that were matched. On April 15th, 49 minutes of deliberation went by. The jury found Speck guilty and recommended the death penalty. On June 5th, Judge Herbert J. Passion sentenced Speck to die in the electric chair, but granted an immediate stay pending automatic appeal. The Illinois Supreme Court subsequently upheld his conviction and death sentence on November 22nd, 1968. On June 28, 1971, the U.S. Supreme Court, citing their June 3, 1968 decision in Witherspoon v. Illinois, upheld Speck's conviction but reversed his death sentence because more than 250 potential jurors were unconstitutionally excluded from his jury because of their contentions or religious beliefs against capital punishment. The case was remanded back to the Illinois Supreme Court for resentencing. On June 29, 1972, in Furman v. Georgia, the U.S. Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional, so the Illinois Supreme Court's only option was to order Speck resentenced to prison by the original Cook County Court. On November 21, 1972, in Peoria, Judge Richard Fitzgerald resentenced Speck to 400 or 1,200 years in prison, eight consecutive sentences of 50 to 150 years. He was denied parole in 7 minutes at his first parole hearing on September 15, 1976, and at six subsequent hearings in 1977, 78, 81, 84, 87, and 1990. While incarcerated at the Statesville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois, Speck was given the nickname Birdman after the film Birdman of Alcatraz because he kept a pair of sparrows that had flown into his cell. He was described as a loner who kept a stamp collection and enjoyed listening to music. His contacts with the warden included requests for new shirts, a radio, and other mundane items. The warden merely described him as a big, nothing-doing time. Speck was not a model prisoner. He was often caught with drugs or distilled moonshine. Punishment for such infractions never stopped him. "How am I going to get in trouble? I'm here for 1,200 years," Speck would say. Speck loathed reporters and granted only one press interview. In 1978, the Chicago Tribune columnist Bob Green, during that interview, he publicly confessed to the murders for the first time and said he thought he would get out of prison between now and the year 2000, at which time he hoped to run his own grocery store business. When Green asked him if he compared himself to celebrity killers like John Dillinger, he replied, "Me? I'm not like Dillinger or anybody else. I'm freakish." Speck stated at the time of the killings, he had no feelings, but things had changed. "I had no feelings at all that night. They said there was blood all over the place. I can't remember. I felt like nothing. I'm sorry as hell. For those girls and for their families and for me. If I had to do it over again, I would be a simple house burglar." Speck's final thought for the American people was, "Just tell them to keep up their hatred for me. I know it keeps up their morale, and I don't know what I'd do without it." In his book, Mindhunter, Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit, John E. Douglas of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit refers to a telling prison incident Speck revealed to him in an interview. He found an injured sparrow that had flown in through one of the broken windows and nursed it back to health. When it was healthy enough to stand, he tied a string around its leg and had it perch on his shoulder. At one point, a guard told him pets weren't allowed. "I can't have it," Speck challenged, then walked over to a spinning fan and threw the small bird in. Horrified, the guard said, "I thought you liked that bird." "I did," Speck replied, "but if I can't have it, no one can." Seems like a lovely individual. The type of guy that you'd want to go into his grocery store. His local IGA, if you will, and go get some lunch meat.
Was he just messing with him? Like, did he really think, like, "Man, I'd be great at running a grocery store"? Like, it makes me think he was messing with him. Because that's so random.
It's random, but you got to understand
I
this.
I love doing inventory.
This
that
person's completely out of their mind. They have no concept of what's normal, what's not normal, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. They have these complexes of if I can't have it, no one can. And eventually some people are going to understand him and he's going to go out and get that IGA. And he's going to make the best goddamn macaroni salad in the world and probably serve Sparrow in the deli as well.
But if you get sick, oh well.
Yeah, I mean, the Richard Speck IGA. It's just like, what the fuck?
That came from nowhere. I wasn't expecting the grocery store.
I know. It's like, that's of all the horrible things that were in that piece to unpack, he's going to run a grocery store. It's like,
I mean, I'd like to get out and have a grocery store. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Would he have done an IGA or a Piggly Wiggly? Which one do you think it would have been?
Depends on what part of the country he was planning on resettling.
Shop the pig. Yeah. It's, wow. Quite an individual.
But the woman who got up, the survivor, and walked to him and pointed directly in his face. Oh, my God. Hats off.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the courage it took to do that.
Yeah.
But she, courage, but also, you know, she was like, I'm going to make this so clear to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would be scared to death to see him again.
Yeah.
Because after what she witnessed and hiding, knowing she could be next and the trauma that went with that and her entire life had to have been filled with trauma, to do that is amazing.
Well, you have to be running it through your mind too, going, okay, yes, obviously he did these horrible things and they finally got him for it, but he's gotten off so many times for other pretty horrible shit. In your mind, you have to also be going, is he going to get out some point? And then to put yourself out there going, I'm the one who put you behind now for this amount of time. It's only, you know, amount of time before you come and kill me and open the Piggly Wiggly. You know, it's.
And to be one of the family members of one of those people he had murdered or the woman he'd raped, I'd be so pissed because they let him go. They let him off so many times along the way.
Yeah.
So many people helped him, basically. I mean, when you don't prosecute, 42 arrests, like, come on.
Yeah.
That was just in Dallas.
Yeah.
I just don't even get that. I'd be pissed because he was still on the street and was able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
It's quite a story. I want to go. I like Mindhunter. I want to watch more of that. I've watched all the episodes.
Hopefully they have some more. I heard that all of the cast has been released from their contracts. I don't know what that means.
I know. And that was before the pandemic. So and everything in Hollywood right now is, as we're recording this on the 23rd of March of 2020, you know, everything is on hold. So God knows what's going to come back or not come back. But yeah, it's a great show. And I was really hoping that they're going to get closer and closer to the BTK story because that's what they keep alluding to. And I'm waiting.
That's where it was going.
Yeah.
So that's how it ended with that creepy scene.
And they're saying more episodes, but they released the cast. So that doesn't make any sense to me. Are they going to come back with like a new cast, like how soaps used to do it, where it's like, today the part of Sophia is being played by Sophia Vergara, you know?
Days of Our Lives.
Yeah, it's like, what?
It's being played by.
Yeah.
One theory that I heard was that they were going to jump ahead in time.
Which may mean new character or new cast, right? Because you have
to. So obviously the guys who are playing the agents now can't play. You know, it's like the Crown.
Yeah.
But if you watch the Crown in a totally different way, it would be like that. So maybe that's what they're doing because the BTK story did have a huge lapse.
Yeah.
And that is a story that you and I talked about a couple weeks ago.
Because they got to jump ahead like almost 25, 30 years.
Right. So maybe they are going to jump ahead.
Maybe. The great actors. It's the shame of it. It's just the actors on the show I love. And I don't
I love it.
Yeah.
And I really do think they could do another season or two with those actors, because it's not all BTK.
Yeah, I agree. If you're looking for a good show to binge on, Mindhunter on Netflix, check it out. It's not an ad.
So good.
Just a very...
And that's one thing we all got right now anyway. March the 23rd is time.
Exactly. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, please be sure to subscribe wherever you download podcasts and let your friends know that we exist. Without that, we would be pretty much, dead in the water. So hope you enjoy it. Many more episodes to come on a weekly basis. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.